The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
It's time for the John DePietro Show here on News Talk, WNRI, 1380 AM and 99.9 and 95.1 FM.
He's a special kind of sentinel.
Mr. DePietro, who is in the eye of the storm.
Suddenly, John DePietro became the story.
Radio talk show host John DePietro.
All right, here we go, folks. Welcome to the lunchtime on this Wednesday, December 4th. Here I am. It's Juan. It is the John DePietro program. We start weekdays at 11, and we go right until 2. It's AM 1380, 99.9 FM. Now, remember, you can always listen online at both DePietro.com or WNRI.com. You just click Listen Live. This portion of the program, folks, is brought to you by Rhode Island's number one garden center, PR Landscape Materials and Garden Center, 3688 Quaker Lane in North Kingstown. Boy, the Christmas season has arrived at PR Landscape Materials and Garden Center. Check out their Facebook page, PR Landscape Materials and Garden Center. They're located right off Route 4, 3688 Quaker Lane in North Kingstown. And especially now, boy, fully stocked, cut Christmas trees from 3 feet, 12 feet, Fraser, balsams, live trees, blue spruce, Alberta spruce, balsams. Wait till you see the selection. This Christmas season, this is the place to get your tree and your wreath. They also have white pine, roping, kissing balls, hanging pots, swags, also bunch greens, all for your decorating needs, and all decorations, their Christmas holiday decorations, all handmade, all high quality. They also make great gifts, by the way. Gift certificates are available. They have customized wreaths, 8 inches to even 60, made on the premises, plain or decorated, huge wreaths, if that's what you're looking for. Decorative pots, 4-inch, 12-inch for your outdoor and indoor displays. All cut trees are baled and placed right on your vehicle, and away you go. Gift certificates are available. Look for them on Facebook this Christmas season. It's PR Landscape Materials and Garden Center, 3688 Quaker Lane in North Kingstown. Well, folks, let's bring them on. We'd like to, I love discussing Rhode Island local politics with him and everything that is local politics. He's the managing editor for OceanStateCarden.com. We normally speak to him on Monday, but on this Wednesday, I usually call it Political Monday, all things politics. Everything is political, whatever it is, whatever you want. Very political. But either way, it's always the managing editor, Justin Katz. Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon, John. Love to be with you.
Good. Thank you, Justin. Hey, Justin, I want to start off last Friday, very extensive story, front page, as a matter of fact. It's kind of interesting, the Journal. I mean, at one time, this would have been a huge deal, but instead, because of the readership is down, and not just with the Journal, people everywhere, people just don't read the paper as much. They get their news elsewhere. But front page, big story, very in-depth, on former Cranston Mayor Steve Laffey, who, there's several things interesting about it, and I'd want to touch on it a little bit. He was last involved with politics. I mean, it's hard to believe. It was 13 years ago, 2006, he lost to Link Chafee in that primary where Chafee beat him. They brought in the ground game for 72 hours. Laffey was leading in the polls, but Chafee, that last-minute surge, cost him like $500,000. They were able to get people to the polls, defeated him. He then left the state. There was rumors around 2010. And then now here it is, 2019, and out of nowhere, I think just because the reporter happened to be out in the area, did a very, very in-depth profile. There's some different interesting things to take away, but I'd like to hear some of your general thoughts on it, and then I'll ask you a few things about it.
Well, it is hard to believe that was 13 years ago, and I do remember a lot of what people questioned, at least on our side of the aisle, was why he ran for Senate. A lot of us wanted Mr. Laffey to run locally, to fix things locally in Rhode Island. And I think that gives us some, you know, there's some excitement justified if he's coming back, mainly because what he always did to excite people was shake things up. And Rhode Island definitely needs some shaking up. How much he'll have the patience to really dig in and make an institutional push to fix Rhode Island, and how much, you know, his kind of cachet has changed over the years. Those are things we're going to have to wait and see. But he was in Rhode Island, you know, I think over the summer and recently, and doing the rounds and talking to people, and seems to be drawn back here in almost a mission-oriented way, which could be great, because things feel kind of stale a lot of the time around here, and as if everything's just going on autopilot. And we need more, you know, more. I think his wife made a comment in the article that there are no big personalities in Colorado. We have maybe too many in Rhode Island, and not enough of them are pushing in the right direction. So that would be a change for the positive. But it's going to be interesting to see what he brings to the state as it is right now.
If he does, it still seemed to me to be left open about fully moving back, running for office. I've known the mayor. I mean, I grew up with the guy. I've known him my entire life. Very successful in business, continues to prosper and do well. I think there's a couple of thoughts about it. I mean, and you saw it just, there's talk that Ken Block may run for governor again. Ken Block, who I know and respect, has never held elected office, and that feels the first office to go after is that of governor. Last fall, he lost in the primary, but Gio Ferrosi, formerly of Alex Anani, had been involved with that, had been a state senator, but decided, no, I need to be, you know, the next governor. I think there's just this fundamental problem also. He was back in May. He spoke at a fundraiser for the Republican Party at Chapel Grill. I just think there's this problem that everybody seems to shoot for the top office. But, you know, as you and I have talked about, I still come back to that there's no discussion, not even from the Journal reporter seemingly interviewing him. Now, again, I don't know, because then you don't know where it starts off and what's edited out. There's nothing brought up about. I just see this fundamental problem with anybody getting elected until the voter roll situation is straightened out, of which the Journal is still battling, in the court. But one thing that Laffey was very effective at, Justin Katz, was he brought to light, through transparent efforts, a lot of these, you know, deals that the unions had in Cranston. And that is something that you just, you know, it continues to be something that needs to be done, which is the shining the light on, like he highlighted that a lot of people didn't get about the crossing cards, was that was just, that was something that blossomed into an outrageous benefit, that you work 2 hours a day and you got free health care for life. I mean, think how many people now would do something like that. I would do something like that. If I could get free health care for life, the Cadillac plan, and I have to do an hour in the morning, an hour at night, I mean, who wouldn't do something like that? But what does it say? I don't know the structure of the party. He also was relentless in trying to hold the unions accountable. And that is the first group that jumps out at me, Justin Katz, is he is like their worst nightmare if someone like a Laffey could establish a foothold of power.
Right. Well, it's that spotlight. You've got it directly. It makes me think of the album cover for U2's Rattle and Hum, where Bono's holding the stage spotlight over the edge, the guitar player. I mean, that's sort of what he did. Here are the traffic cards, and here's this deal they've got, and it's representative of so many bigger problems. That kind of an attitude. And there was also a controversy with the school department, and people had come after him for it. And he said, "Hey, let's go protest the school department."
That's right.
And, you know, put the spotlight where it needs to be. And so that could be, like I said, he shakes things up, and that could be very helpful. One of the problems we run into repeatedly, though, is this idea of people going for the top spot. But, you know, that's feasible. Kercheri won the governor's seat. But it's this battle of egos. And so that's part of the question is, he were to come back, how would it integrate with the mix of egos that are and personalities that are on the table right now? I think there's a lot of positive possibility if everybody could find a way to focus on the right things and to take the spotlight and build on it. But it's landscape's changed a bit since he was here. We've now not had a Republican governor in a decade. It is an open question whether the landscape is the same, but that's part of what would be the exciting question to answer, is if somebody came in with that changed that attitude that he brought to the table last time he was in the state. Could we get back to where that spotlight focuses again where it needs to be, and people start to wake up and sense that there's a chance for change? I mean, when he left, he said, well, Rhode Island's not ready for the change that I would bring. But to a big degree, you've got to make it ready. You can't just wait for people to decide. Unless
right.
You wait for people
I agree
to
with
laugh.
You.
So,
yeah. You
know, hopefully that'll be his attitude when he comes back.
That line of somehow then the state would, you know, everyone would come together and say, you know, you're our savior and so forth. It just that's never going to happen like that. I think now again, this is someone, and I meet a lot of these people that run for office. He has a brilliant mind, Harvard Business School. He is fantastic at retail politics. Would go door to door, make an impact. In that 2010 race, he would have blown away the field had he chosen to run for governor. Just as far as his knack for making an argument, he's a tremendous debater. You go back to that 2010 race he almost got into. John Robitaille, no one knew who he was. He was just the alternative. Chafee, we saw what happened with Chafee. Chafee is, and I want to touch on that in a moment. Frank Caprio, who at one point was seen, he couldn't communicate. I mean, the guy, Frank Caprio, was like the worst communicator ever. It's even unimaginable that he actually thought he was going to be governor in the treasurer again. But Laffey was very, he's great at politics. He's great at the shaking hands. He enjoys campaigning. He enjoys meeting people. He's quick on his feet. He understands the problems. I just don't think the state's ever going to be that way. What did you make of the fact that then he tried to almost like an olive branch of like, you know, Chafee was a nice guy. I just don't think politics was his thing, but nice guy. But Chafee ever, you know, to me, he's always linked Chafee, the former governor, has always been kind of that passive aggressive, wouldn't pass up the chance to take a shot emailing the Journal. Of all the wins I've ever had, that was the most enjoyable win, beating him in the primary. You know, I think it speaks volumes that years later, Laffey resisted taking a shot at Chafee, and then Chafee still, and he should hold no resentment towards Laffey, right? He beat him and then became governor, and even now supposedly may run for president. But Chafee couldn't resist taking another dig at Laffey.
Yeah, I think the passive-aggressive is exactly the term. And, you don't want to speak of people in cliches, but you do get the sense of, you know, Chafee became, in some respects, a laughingstock.
Well, in every respect, he did. But, let's call it. Yeah, he was. Yeah. He was a laughingstock. He was a punchline in Rhode Island. He remains a punchline. He is. He never got past that Christmas tree. He got fully exposed. He is a laughingstock.
Well, and I don't even mean that, but I mean it compounds up the scale, right up to national. When there were talk show hosts saying, "Let's get Lincoln Chafee to 1% in the presidential race," and making fun of him for that. And
yeah.
The whole thing with the metric system. And
yep.
I mean, so it's kind of to be expected. Here's this guy always being laughed at, thinks he's doing great work and he's a great politician. And so that's the kind of person who will, you know, 13 years later be making a passive aggressive comment about, "I enjoyed rubbing his face in the dirt," you know, that kind of a thing. You know, it's not surprising at all that he would respond that way. He's probably went back to whatever he's doing out there in Wyoming and chuckled to himself, "Ha ha ha, that was a great zinger." Kind of like George Costanza in Seinfeld with the jerk store call.
That's right. You know, they're all out of you at the jerk store. That's exactly right. Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. We're speaking with Justin Katz, managing. Excellent reference, Justin. I love the Seinfeld reference. I want to jump to and also, just final thought on that. If everything holds true, we could be looking at a three. I don't know if Fung is going to run for governor again. I hear different things that if Nirona runs for governor, which I don't think he would, Fung would look at the AG slot. Fung hasn't ruled out running again. I'm hearing from different people, Ken Block may run for governor again as a Republican. I don't have any confirmation of that. It could end up Fung, Laffey, and Block in a primary, or maybe it doesn't. Maybe you know, Laffey would want to try to clear the field. Ken Block's never, as much as I respect him, he's never held elected office. Some of these people sometimes have to wonder if just maybe, for whatever reason, they're just unelectable. But I want to jump to, and you wrote about this. This is one of those stories that just shows you the power of the unions. And that is this story, incredible story, about these misplaced breathing tubes. The power of the union is so powerful that they'll take people dying because the breathing tubes are put in incorrectly, as opposed to in any way cutting back on, and I'll have you explain it a little bit better, but there has to be some union benefit that they're allowed to do this procedure to put in the breathing tube. And I'm going to imagine it leads to more pay and high pay for the union members. But they are literally killing people. In other states, they don't. And no one will speak up against it because they don't want to speak out against the union.
Well, that's the, to me, the very key indication. So what we're talking about here are firefighters who are EMTs, certified as EMT slash cardiac, which means they can do certain things, like insert a breathing tube. In Rhode Island, they're able to do this. Most states, you have to be a paramedic to do it, and national standards are generally that only paramedics can do it. There was a local doctor who had some research assistants doing other research on patients who were brought into the ER, and they discovered that there were 11, I think, cases of misplaced breathing tube. And so basically when we put the breathing tube down the esophagus, it puts air in your stomach and suffocates the patient. So they found that there were 11 cases where this was misplaced. All of them died, and only one out of the 11 was a paramedic. 10 of them were these EMT cardiacs. And so this the doctor raised it as an issue and started to question the policy to allow EMT cardiacs to do this. What gets me, and what really to me illustrates the problem and the danger of the labor unions in the state, is they're instantly on a war footing. This isn't just, oh, here's some interesting data, let's look at this and decide what's best for our patients, the people we're trying to take care of. It's suddenly, you've got Mayor Policino, who was himself an EMT cardiac, saying, oh, this is a war on the EMTs, and you're trying to kill town hall. And you've got Paul Valletta, who your listeners know that name very well. You've got him, you know, saying we're the experts, the doctors in our nice cushy little hospitals and emergency rooms. They don't know what they're talking about. Instead of what they should do is say, we hadn't considered that data. Well, let's look at it. Let's figure out what's going on and see if our policy is addressed. That's the problem here is you, as a Rhode Islander, you can't expect that the government is honestly considering what's going on. I mean, I did a little bit of independent research having read that article, and from what I can tell, the article cited a 4% error rate with these missed tubes. From what I can tell, that's not necessarily outside of the range of what's experienced nationally. So if that's the case, then, you know, we can discuss why it's happening, figure out ways to resolve it, but they don't want any hint that anybody can come in and question anything their members have done. For two reasons. First, they've got to sell themselves to their members and say, look, without us, they'd be taking your life away. And two, the more their members can do, the more restrictions on others and the more insulated they are, the more leverage the union has. And so that's a huge concern to me, is that we've got this issue of people dying. And it was a high profile case a few years ago, which helped to bring it to light. And it becomes another political fight to these people, and that's just disturbing.
You know, Justin, that's an excellent point. And this is an element of, like, life and death. Many times we, you know, hear the phrase, people say, hey, listen, this isn't life and death. This is life and death. And even then, you know, that is a great way to look at it. They do go into war mode. And, like, you doctors in your cushy little operating room and blah, blah, blah. And my God, I mean, people are dying because of this. But they in any way, anyone that tries to interfere, if they view as interfering with their situation, they view it as you go into attack mode. And the fact, like, even I think the doctor said he was shocked that people were cheering in the room and carrying on. My God, I mean, there's no way to maybe expect that these people would not make these types of mistakes, but we're not. To me, it just shows how severe it is. You're not talking about that people are inconvenienced. You're not talking about that the taxpayer has to pay above and beyond. You're literally talking of life and death. People are dying because of these types of mistakes, and yet they see no accountability. They don't take any responsibility, and they have no interest in changing the equation.
And the whole thing shows the entire Rhode Island system. So the whole scene the doctor found shocking was in front of an advisory board, which is just, you know, some non-elected board of people appointed by elected officials it's supposed to have no real substantive role except to give some advice to the actual officials, but it, in practice, it's become the governing body for EMTs. They're in front of this board. It ought to be, you know, the nice, quiet, you know, peaceful, you know, the union representatives ought to have sat down at the table and said, yes, this data disturbs us as well, and we want to look into this with you and make sure we're doing the best for Rhode Islanders. But instead, it becomes this political show, like we've talked about, with teachers' unions filling a town council hall, screaming, let's move the meeting, all that kind of stuff. And so they go there, and what's next? Of course, in Rhode Island, the next step is the labor unions push their friends in a general assembly to change the makeup of that board, so that it's even more strongly in their favor. And it just the whole thing, it really starts to make you think, you know, is it even, as I wrote in my post on this, is it even reasonable to expect people to invest their lives in Rhode Island if this is the way things operate? And it always goes back to the same characters. Paul Valletta is a big one. And it always goes back to the same process. Some question gets raised up. They fight back that you can't even ask the question, and then they change the law to make sure that even if you ask the question, it's going to have no effect in the future. And that's just not you. The doctor you mentioned, he was actually an EMT himself before he became a doctor, and so that's one of the reasons he was shocked. You want people to raise questions when they think they've found something, and you know what? If you show them that their data is wrong or that it's not out of the ordinary for 4% of these to be misplaced, then that would be good news, because then you'd be discovering, okay, good, our data is not a problem. But that's not how we operate around here. We're not even allowed to ask questions, or that's a war on the unions, and that's what's scary about it.
Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. We're speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. Justin, you recently, the Providence Journal, published your piece, Progressively Worse Economic Policies. Take us through it a little bit. It's a great read.
Well, what I find hilarious about this, so for years, I've been pointing out that the Raimondo administration and their satellite of supporters loves to manipulate employment data and say, oh, look, we've got this low unemployment rate. The reason we've got a low unemployment rate is because so many people have left the labor force. They just gave up and left the state or decided not to work, go on disability or whatever they were able to do. And so that's why our unemployment rate looks good. And so here are Bruce Katz, who's formerly of the Brookings Institute. He's a progressive economic development guru. And Stephen Pryor, who's one of Raimondo's chief cheerleaders, the commerce czar for her administration. And they're giving this presentation about their new economic development process. And here, look at unemployment. Here's how successful we've been. And it's a bunch of baloney. But then Sam Bell, progressive state senator from Providence, steps up to the microphone and actually doubles down on the baloney of the statistics to say, oh, look, before Raimondo, our unemployment rate was getting down even better than it was now. And that's because of your corporate policies. And it's just so extreme that it highlights how one generation of progressive is going to be more pure than the previous generation. And as they get in office and they have to try to actually make things work, I mean, Bell's big complaint is that the Raimondo administration tries to bribe businesses to come here and tolerate our horrible economic environment. And to him, that's just not allowed. It's too much giveaways to corporations. So here, the pure progressive wants to come in and take the legs out from under the table entirely. And so I thought that was just a very telling dynamic. And it's always fun to catch Sam Bell, because you can almost hear in his voice that he's just having so much fun saying anything, and none of it matters. He can say whatever he thinks he needs to say in a moment, and he just loves that he gets away with it. But that was the gist of it.
Speaking of the governor and also economic development, what is your thought? I know we have a long way to go, but what is your first thought on the rollout now that Pawtucket could have this soccer stadium, $400 million development deal? So much of this stuff now, to me, it's kind of like, let me know when it actually happens or is close to. I don't even know what is real. There's so many different things that need to come together in some ways for these things to happen. But just what's your initial impression on this redevelopment package in the city of Pawtucket?
Well, the initial impression is when Mayor Grabian of Pawtucket says, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. I think, well, how often have we heard that? I mean, it's the bad sales pitch entry. To me, I don't know. My first thought is, no public money. End of story. You know, if somebody needs public money to do a business venture, it means we're making it too hard for them to do business. So we need to change that and not give them money. But a lot of, in this case, a lot of the details that were given out just don't seem to add up to me. So they're citing as $400 million the total project, which is a soccer stadium on one side of the river, a pedestrian bridge across the river, to housing and new housing development and new shops and that kind of thing. So they're saying $400 million total, with up to $90 million of that coming from the state and city, 80 from the state, 10 from the city, presumably. And then the stadium itself is $45 million. So this, and the state's also saying that their $90 million will only cover the bridge, parking, infrastructure type stuff. So where's this other 200 something million dollars going to and coming from? So I'm having a hard time believing that the $90 million cited is the end of Rhode Island's, quote, you know, public investment in this project. I also have some skepticism, which was expressed, I think, in the Boston Globe by a sports economist from Holy Cross University or college, where he said, you know, they're only this will be the second tier of professional soccer. So it's sort of like a minor, the biggest of the minor leagues. But 30 minutes away, you have New England Revolution, which is professional soccer. So what's the market for two professional soccer teams within 30 minutes of each other? I think that's going to be a tough sell as well. And so a lot of the details have to come out, and we need to stay skeptical and not kind of get swept up in the, you know, sale of a lifetime kind of rhetoric, especially when we see things like Dan Connors, who's a former Senate Majority Leader, who's now being appointed inside the Raimondo administration as an advisor for six figures of pay. He is actually the lobbyist for the developer who wants to do this, and now suddenly he's getting a job in a Raimondo administration. A lot of it starts to not add up, and you feel like, you know, something's going wrong here, especially when it's based on legislation from last year that made eminent domain easier when there's a tax increment finance bond deal involved in the mix. And you can see how long this has been in the works, and it just seems, I don't know, the red flags start to land on the field, although it's a different sport.
I agree. You know, it's so far, so many different things would have to come together. I don't know what to make of it yet. I mean, I'd like to try to be optimistic. I don't try to just be a naysayer. I agree with you on why there has to be public financing. Part of me tends to think that sometimes, and I don't know who this developer is, that they kind of feel that they're dealing with local yokels, and it almost seems like you give them the promise there's going to be something huge, get them excited, and then you start to just up the ante of how much you're actually going to want. Just because then they're that much farther along on the hook. As far as the soccer, I mean, the Paw Sox, I think if the Paw Sox could do, well, there's a lot of different things about this. The Paw Sox, when you think about it, they played a lot more games. And there's no way soccer plays every single night the way baseball does. The Paw Sox, if the Paw Sox could get 8,000 to 10,000 a game, that's a really good crowd at McCoy. A lot of times they're much smaller than that. So the way the changing dynamic, especially in the northern part of the state, the Pawtucket, Central Falls, Providence, East Providence, I maybe soccer is the way to go, especially over the next, if you're looking down the road 10 to 15 years, I think soccer is going to be more on the rise as opposed to baseball. But it's just so tough, as you say, to judge if it's good when immediately you have an inside player that Connors, he was big with Montalbano, who then now is coming back into the mix. That's a good segue for what I wanted to ask you about also, is this now this business that Brett Smiley, who by all accounts is going to run for mayor. So now he's going to run for mayor of Providence as he is director of administration, but he's going to step over to be the director of administration. And what I think is dangerous about that job, basically you control who gets a job. And to me, Smiley is going to use that to just immediately start handing out favors that will later be cashed in when you want to run for mayor. You are looking at a pool of applicants of 10 people, 15 for a job, and it starts to really become who can help me when I run for mayor, because by all accounts, he is going to run for mayor. What also jumps out at me is that David Ortiz, who works for Governor Raimondo, he's now going to be taking Smiley's job, $185,000. Now, that's just salary, plus they get benefits, plus they get vacation and health care and blah, blah, blah. Justin, I come back to, so no one else could do that job for $50,000 less. There's no one that would want to be the chief of staff of the governor for for 140? I mean, it just, was that a deal breaker for him? Did he say unless it's 185, which really is worth, my God, it's really worth well over 200,000 when you think about the free health care and everything, because if you just get health care now, it's 25,000 for a family. So I just, the amount of money they pay these people, they think they're in the private sector. That's how it breaks out.
Yeah, well, it's worship is more than the private sector. I mean, you've got all these layers of people who can shuffle around in all these six-figure jobs. It's worth noting that for Smiley, actually, this is a
pay cut.
I think it was 191. And
right, 191 to 155.
So there's, and the fact that they're calling him interim, I wonder if there's some question where he's on his way out, and to run for mayor, or maybe he sits there through the election. Well, I guess we'll find that out over time. But on the rest, I agree. Well, first of all, I've never seen Brett Smiley evidence that he's this great administrator, which you would think that the director of administration would be more of an administrator
right.
type with a lot of business experience. He may have political experience, which
right.
is why maybe chief of staff works. So you do have to wonder how he's actually a fit, and that might be interesting. Right now, one of the questions here is whether the Senate's going to get an opportunity to opine on his appointment. The governor doesn't seem to want to do that, although it appears to be required in state law, which they apparently don't follow all the time. So that could be an interesting political discussion. But I had the same response as you to looking at all these numbers. Why are they all making so much? And what are we getting for that money? And was there nobody else in the state of Rhode Island or beyond who was more qualified to run an administrative office for $150,000-something? Those are the questions that inevitably arise, and especially when all the players are shuffling around between the mayor's office, Smiley and Ortiz, I believe, started with Elorza, moved to the governor. Then you've got Connors, who's a lobbyist and a lawyer who was Senate Majority Leader. When that starts happening, you start to question whether you're really hiring people to do jobs as much as just shuffling around political appointees for their own purposes, which goes right back to your observation that this is going to be an opportunity for Smiley to be handing out jobs and currying political favor for a potential run for mayor.
Well, why else would you want to do that? He's making 191, which is obscene. Now he's going to take a pay cut to 155. Why would you do that? Because you can give a lot of people jobs when you are director of administration, which he's apparently going to be, and then far more. It's not enough just to give out jobs as governor. No, when you're there, those are then state jobs you can give out. That's how you build your foundation base. And how much is it worth to him? I mean, you do the math. It's worth him taking almost a $40,000 pay cut, but it'll be worth it to him to what he'll make up with that. I also take Senate President Dominic Ruggiero fired a warning shot over her decision to designate him as acting director, then formally nominating him, saying we expect the governor in January, the governor will submit a nominee to the Senate for advice and consent as required. Then we'll give him due consideration. Well, immediately, that is Dominic Ruggiero making sure that Smiley understands that there's going to be a cost if you want that job in order to get approved through the Senate. There's going to be a wish list of people that we want to make sure a certain number that we can give out jobs. It's never ending, Justin. And no one ever, like to me, as soon as I saw that, it's not a matter of, to me, the way I read that is Senate President Dominic Ruggiero wants to make sure that they follow what the law is, which is you have to nominate someone for Senate confirmation. He just wants it clear that there's a price they have to meet. Now, the governor will owe him a favor, meaning, you know, hey, listen, I need your support on this to get him through. Then Smiley owes him a favor, and it's all about favors. That's how I read it immediately. He's making it very clear that in order for this to pass, he's gonna want something in return.
Yeah, and that brings up the question of where actually is the payoff for all of these people. I mean, the Senate president doesn't get a whole lot of money in his job. So where's the payoff for him for getting favors? And for that matter, where's the payoff for Brett Smiley? I haven't checked. I'm pretty sure this mayor of Providence makes even less than the 155 that he'll be taking as Department of Administration. So what makes it worth your while to continually take pay cuts
right.
in order to get into a political seat like that? There must be some payoff elsewhere. And I think we've seen some indication of where that is in Dan Connors, where he was in politics and now here he is getting a six-figure job in state government because of trading on his political experience. And I think there's always that payoff somewhere in a private sector that's a few steps beyond what the Ethics Commission might sniff out.
Yeah, and as far as with Connors, I don't know if they've revealed. I think, is he part of a law firm? Because then I just wonder, I mean, you want to talk about helping a law firm. You get one of the principal people in it into the governor's office. And then even if obviously, you know, they'd say, oh, there's a, they used to say, there's going to be a firewall now between Connors and any work that's done. If he is in fact still part of that firm, well, then the money just flows in. That was, you know, years ago, John Harwood's firm had the account for, at the time, it was Lincoln Greyhound, Lincoln Downs. And then he used to say, oh, no, it's never discussed. But, you know, the amount of money that would flow in into the law firm, he didn't have to necessarily be the person, you know, that was handling the account. The money was still, a signal was sent, kind of like what Hunter Biden took advantage of in the Ukraine with that. But any other thought, you know, this Smiley thing, to me, it's all strategic. It doesn't mean he's the best qualified. It doesn't mean that he knows what needs to be done. It's completely approved. He's going to use this in order to feather his nest with political favors by handing out jobs that are going to come in handy for then when he wants people's support to be mayor of Providence.
Sure, and as a taxpayer, what always comes to my mind when I see these stories is the amount of mental energy and plotting that goes into making these kind of decisions. You know, not when you don't have just a job interview of a bunch of people and put the best person in a position, but rather you're shuffling characters around. This is all mental energy that's not being spent governing the state of Rhode Island.
And, yep.
In that regard, we've seen the fruits in Raimondo's administration, I think, over her term and a half, or term and a year.
Yeah, Connor's a lawyer at Providence firm Duffy and Sweeney, state senator. He'll make $166,000 per year as a senior advisor. Now, and that means he'll be a senior advisor to the governor, but then at the same time, whatever equity he gets, if you're someone that needs something from the governor's office, I would imagine an easy way to do that is if you hire the law firm Duffy and Sweeney in order to handle something for you, give them a retainer of some sorts, and I would imagine you get your phone calls returned a lot sooner. Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. We're speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. Justin, finally, before I let you go, any thought on the governor's people deciding we're just going to go with an artificial tree at the Rhode Island State House instead of a real tree? I know some people could dismiss it, but to me, how is that possible? I mean, all these years, you have the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree. You have the White House Christmas tree. For years, having the Governor Kachiri, there was never a problem with the tree. Even when Chafee wouldn't call it a tree, it's a tree. They're just so dismissive with how they handle problems. To me, that's not solving. They didn't solve the problem. I think it's indicative of how they approach things. Is just like, well, forget it then. We're just going to get an artificial tree. But they never solved the actual problem that someone was unable to manage an indoor live tree. That's not, they never solved the problem. It's like they just get out of the business of trying to solve the problem.
Well, you touched on exactly my response to this. It's a great metaphor, I think, for the state of Rhode Island's government at this point. I mean, if you run through the history of the trees, the sort of the foibles of the State House Christmas trees, I mean, they killed one with a spray because of a ridiculous fire code. Chafee tried to change the name for politically correct reasons. At one year, Raimondo bought one that was too small. One of them, often they dry out too soon because they keep that state house so warm throughout the winter. And so rather than fixing all of the reasons they're not doing things right, you know, watching temperature and not having a ridiculous fire code that makes you kill your tree, all of these problems we have in the state, rather than fix them, they say, you know what, we'll just get a fake one, and that'll be fine. And in some ways, it's a lot like saying we're going to give out special deals to businesses because we're not willing to fix our economic climate in this state. It's a very, very representative metaphor for Rhode Island. And in some ways, you know, that's – oh, and to top it all off, it was bought with donated political funds. So, you know, there you go. You've got the perfect Rhode Island metaphor going into the Christmas season.
That's right. And then finally, the Journal did have this editorial, bullying letter could backfire. You and I talked about this, but that is that wasn't enough the teachers union, that they got the forever evergreen contract provision. Then sending a letter to different people threatening them, saying, you know, the lawsuit's a waste of taxpayer dollar. The Journal writes, let's hope community leaders are not as malleable and different to the plight of local taxpayers. Court recognized no justice in stalling a playing field. They also write, if the unions truly believe the case is airtight, they may better stand back, wait for the court to act, and would probably be after the election. You tell me. I think that if they will recognize this, it's like a battle. You set up a board of the cities and towns, who they have they can control, who then would need an opponent, and that's how they play. That's the game they play. They're not going to wait for a court system. They will have time and threaten people that if you're on city council, in this particular case, Cranston, unless you say, hey, let's drop this lawsuit, you're going to have an opponent up against you in that race. As much as the Journal saying it could backfire, I'm going to hold my breath that people are actually going to start to grow a backbone and stand up to this crowd.
Well, it's tough to expect that. I mean, it's the full court press all the time. They'll go after things at the negotiating table. When that's not working, they'll try to get legislation. They'll fight in the courts. They'll fight, at the ballot box by trying to elect people. It's gotten to the point in recent elections where the whole mask is coming off. All of the veils are coming down, and they're actually just electing union members to be on school committees and local boards, not just union members, but union executives and activists. So it's a lot to beat back against because they do have a lot of taxpayer money. And now, especially, the unions, especially the teachers unions have essentially merged with the progressive movement, which funnels in a whole separate amount of money and influence and workforce for you to go, political workforce. So that it is not an idle threat. And I don't think, I wouldn't have any confidence that it's going to backfire unless people wake up to what they're doing. And I haven't seen a whole lot of evidence that that's happening.
I agree with you. Folks, he's the managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. He's Justin Katz. Justin, excellent as always. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks, John. Talk to you in a few.
All right, folks, there it is. Justin Katz right here on the John DePietro Show. With